Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
7 points to show for it on the board. Second and five. Again, touchdown. Marty Booker. Doesn't get a bounce. Oh, there's a high hop. It is. A pile up inside midfield. Let's see who comes up with the football. Bears ball.
Watch the ball. It does not take a good hop, so no Brown defender can come up and catch it. Now goes in the air. Percy Ellsworth hits it. Jerry Azuma knocks it out of the hands.
Kick. Bears are out of timeouts.
Gotta take your time.
Steps up, gonna go for it all in the end zone. Jump ball. Caught! It's caught! James Allen was there for the tip.
Shane Matthews stepping up in the pocket, allowed the receivers to get in the end zone, create the tip for the catch by James Allen.
In the lineup now for Cleveland. Couch out of the shotgun. Throws. That's batted into the air. Intercepted, and the Bears are going to win it. Mike Brown has done it again.
Hey, Browns. Mike Polk, season ticket holder. Killer game in Houston today.
Well, thank God we built you. What a blessing for the community.
You are wasting valuable space on our majestic shoreline, and what do we get out of it from you? 10 miserable games a year, including 2 preseason games that I have to pay for, and 1 shitty Kenny Chesney concert. Do you understand that it is actually statistically harder for a team to be this consistently bad than it is for them to occasionally accidentally be good?
The probability is staggering.
Did you happen to see that Packers-Chargers game today? It's like they're playing a different sport than you are. And here's what you have to understand. We don't even expect you to be good. We just want you to be watchable. Do you have any idea how low our expectations are? We don't expect you to win the Super Bowl. We just want you to look better than a Division III high school team.
And listen, I know that there are way more important things in life than football, but you are supposed to be our pleasant distraction from those things.
But all we do is pay you money to put us in a bad mood every week.
You are a factory of sadness!
I'll see you Sunday.
Welcome back to another exciting edition of the Pointless Exercise Podcast. It's time to remember this crap with Mike Donahue. Mike, how are you?
Good, Andy. How are you?
I'm terrific. Bears are on a one-game winning streak. They don't have a redheaded quarterback anymore, and they're off to play their former preseason arch rivals, the Cleveland Browns.
I'm not even sure what you're referring to, but I will tell you that the Browns are one of the few teams I've not seen in person in a regular season game, but I did see them in preseason. But you're referencing something that I'm not quite grasping.
For many years, up until recently, for whatever reason, the Bears and Browns seem to always play the last preseason game against each other, the one nobody ever wanted to go to.
I just block out preseason games. I didn't even know that.
I was thinking of that when I was looking at the, so these are old franchises, right? The Browns go back.
Yep.
Do you know how many times they've played?
Well, I have a guess because I was pondering it after playing the Bengals and, realizing that because they're in the AFC, They nowadays only can only play every 4 years, used to be every 3 years. But I would almost guess that they haven't played the Browns that much more than the Bengals, in spite of the fact that they predate the AFL and they've been in the NFL since 1950. There's not much history there.
So the Bears and Bengals, that was the 12th matchup. Is that right? On Sunday?
I believe that's correct.
I think the Bears, the Bears had a 6-5-0 advantage, which they pushed to 7-5-0. Browns and Bears have played more, but not a lot more. This will be the 17th time.
Yeah, I'm not surprised because they don't.
Well, and for whatever reason, they only played once in the 70s.
Well, they only played the Bengals once in the 70s, so I'm still trying to figure out what was going on with the schedule. Well, as well as we talked about this, as well as I had the schematic, the formula down for how schedules worked beginning in 79 with a 28-team league and a 16-game schedule. It was very logical, somewhat. I can't account for how they did it in the 70s. I can only tell you that they played the Bengals one time, and I'm guessing the Browns one time, maybe the Steelers one time. Were they playing the Raiders a lot? I don't know. I haven't gotten to the bottom of it, but for some reason or another, they haven't played. They didn't play AFC Central teams, the four-team division. And that's also funny because Cleveland and Pittsburgh, of course, were two of the old NFL teams that joined all of the nascent formerly AFL teams that currently, that comprise the American Football Conference. So at least since the 1970 season, I guess they haven't had a lot of cause to meet that often, but the Bears don't have much history with either the Browns and the Steelers. They go back further with the Browns, but the reason they don't have a history with the Browns is the Steelers. The Bears don't have much of a history with the Steelers, even though they go back to 1920 and Hal is loaning money to Art Rooney, winning money at the horse track and buying the Steelers, is that the Steelers were so historically perennially awful for about five, right before the Super Bowl era. And we'll get to that. We'll get to that when we cover Pittsburgh. So, but it is odd. It's odd that the Bears and Browns, they have a very storied decade that were actually subsequent to one another. Bears in the 40s, Browns in the 50s. They go back, but they very rarely cross paths. But there are a lot of similarities.
So do you know who leads the series?
It's
close. So I guess it's a crapshoot.
Yeah.
Nine and seven.
I'm going to guess the Browns.
The Browns. Although the Bears have won 3 in a row and 4 out of 5.
Is that right?
Yes. So
what's interesting about kind of diving into the Browns, Andy, a week after doing the Bengals is I know that we call you. You've talked about this before. Remember this crap, not research this crap. But subsequent to the show we did last week, I'm discussing Paul Brown. I sort of found myself going down the Wikipedia rabbit hole and learned a few things. And I thought, since we're in this sort of continuation, we're kind of in the Paul Brown series, I wanted to sort of drill a little bit deeper because you made a couple of observations that I thought were spot on. Uh-huh. But then also the one thing that was spot on that you came across was the parallels between the current day Brown family and the current day descendants of George Halas. And that's as it pertains to the Bengals more so than the Browns.
Yes.
And that's completely valid. And it's also valid about how
the Browns are now owned by truck stop magnet Jimmy, not magnet, magnate. I mean, you can get a magnet at a truck stop.
Sure.
Jimmy Haslam.
Oh, that's right. I didn't know he was a truck stop. So he's like TNA or
Flying J.
Oh, yeah. I know the Flying J. I've seen a few of those in Michigan. Okay. No, but and actually that's going to get me to my point too. The one discovery I made. So that was a good observation. The other one of the he's kind of a little bit of a George Halas type in his own right. Another good observation. But then one thing that I made the discovery and I felt it was appropriate to set the record straight because it's kind of opens up the world to a more fascinating tale is that in fact, Paul Brown, unlike what we both assumed, and a lot of people did much like George Halas, was the owner of the Cleveland Browns. And he never really was. It's just, you know, it's funny because you think, well, they're named the Browns, this and that. And we kind of assume it to be like Hallis. And, you know, Hallis' story.
Weren't they named in honor of him?
Well, that's it. So Paul Brown grew up in Ohio, born in 1908. He played football, was around in the 20s when he was a kid, Massillon Washington High School. And then he enrolls at Ohio State, but he's too small to play quarterback. He transfers to Miami of Ohio, and he plays a lot alongside Weeb Eubank at Miami of Ohio. He graduates, and then he goes into coaching high school football at his alma mater and turns him into this powerhouse. I think that at one point he went 80 wins, 8 losses, and 1 tie at the Ohio State University in a controversial move that was actually somewhat presaged a few decades later by Notre Dame hiring another Ohio football legend in high school, Jerry Faust.
God, yes.
But Ohio State hired this Paul Brown character, who then led the university to the school's first ever national title in his second season, 42. He ends up when World War II is going on. He gets assigned as a lieutenant, and then he's out at North Chicago at the Great Lakes Naval Base coaching that team where George Hallis had played for that team in the 1918 Rose Bowl, and he was the MVP. Hallis, just by comparison's sake, and for any Bears fans that might not know it, and sometimes I forget it, but, you know, Hallis himself was, you know, he was the son of immigrants from the west side of Chicago, born in 1895. He's 13 years older than Paul Brown, but obviously a special individual, a smart guy. He graduates from Illinois, where he plays football, gets a degree in civil engineering, and then he enlists, or he goes into the Naval Reserves. He plays for Great Lakes, like I said, plays in the 1918 Rose Bowl, becomes MVP. The next year, he's playing a few games in right field for the New York Yankees, of course. There's a baseball reference page for George Hallis. He himself propagated the myth that Babe Ruth succeeded him, but anybody that has access to baseball reference will see that George Steely Hallis is 2 for 22. 1919 didn't really make him their right fielder. Nevertheless, a year after that, when he's only 25, he's playing football, working for A.E. Staley, a grain manufacturer downstate in Decatur, and blah, blah, blah. And whatever savings or loans he took out, Hallis cobbled together enough to sort of buy in and then sort of buy out Staley. And he was the outright owner, you know, even though obviously it was a different playing field, because in 1921, he's buying low. The NFL is still kind of a rogue league, but whatever resource Hallis had, he was the outright owner, you know, at the age of like 26, and the rest is history, built the wealth there. Paul Brown, a little bit different, despite having some similarities and playing, you know, and coaching the Great Lakes. But at this point, when the war ends and he's supposed to go back to Ohio State, because he was on leave for Great Lakes, he's, you know, at this point, Paul Brown's 37, 38, but then he takes up this offer by this taxi cab magnet character named Mickey McBride, who was born in Chicago and may have had mob connections. Hmm. He was the owner. He was the financier, but he did. He rallied around Brown's image. Brown was already a legend. He was a high school legend. He leads Ohio State to the title. So Brown managed to build on that sort of his own brand, and also had enough to buy in for 15%, but he was never more than a 15% owner in the Browns. Just to wrap up this long-winded history, but I did find it interesting. McBride sold the Browns after like the 53 season. And, you know, at this point, Brown had won four AAFC titles. He had already won 2 NFL titles. He took the league by storm after they joined. The Browns played in 6 straight championship games as soon as they joined the NFL. They were a powerhouse. Brown was a legend. And he did sort of leverage his position, even with change of ownership. They changed ownership again in 61 when Art Modell, a 35-year-old New York ad man, acquired the team. And Modell gave Paul Brown an 8-year contract, but fired him 2 years later and bought him out for $500,000. And so he was in exile for 5 years. Played a lot of golf, and I think the Wikipedia article points out that Brown, it was said that only Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer made more money playing golf. So he did build his wealth, and he bought back into the Rams for, I think, a 30% share. And eventually they were able to, you know, he got up to that Hallis level, but it was a slightly different history. And I just thought it was worth mentioning, because I found it pretty interesting. You know, they have his name, But he never was, in fact, really the primary owner. But he was obviously a larger-than-life presence that, you know, kind of accounted for all that.
It's a terrible nickname.
It is. It's the worst caller.
I mean,
on the spectrum.
So I think two of the worst nicknames. If you actually sit and think about what they are,
can
the Browns,
the
which
one?
Is a color. Yeah, Packers? Can you guess the other one?
Is it Packers?
Well, the Packers, is no. That's pretty dumb.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah. What did you have in mind?
The White Sox.
Okay.
White Sox.
At least
that's
Red
your
Sox
fucking,
have
that's
color.
Your nickname? Yeah, at least the Red Sox is a color.
Not I mean, the absence.
Calling yourself after Sox is dumb. I mean, of course, we had the Cincinnati Reds.
Red Stockings at one point when they didn't want to be
well, that was right. That was during the communist scare. That was the only reason they added stockings.
But you're right.
There's a lot of dumb stuff. Yeah,
yeah, in the olden days. Now, but yeah, so, Browns, and I don't know, like if Brown, there is a little bit ambiguous as to whether or not he truly did not have the ego and was humbled and didn't want them to be the Browns. That's one story, or maybe he passive aggressively played behind the scenes and manipulated so he could get that glory. But he was on record as being against the name. As it turns out.
Well, it's weird. I mean,
yeah, you kind of, I mean, kind of believe your own
bullshit. There was probably a time when you could have got enough Meatball Bear fans to go, I think it would be a good idea to be the Ditkas. I mean, come on. He's a Hall of Fame player. He's a Hall of Fame coach. He won a Super Bowl.
The fighting Ditkas. It's like the leprechaun, but Ditkas.
He gave me an angioplasty in the back of the steakhouse. At least that's what he called it.
Well, like, so the Bears
now Angioplasty. That I'll write that up. That could be a character in season two of Chicago Party.
Chicago Ant. Party Ant. Yeah, exactly.
She runs a bar. Angioplasty runs a bar.
That's a free one. If they're listening, they can have it.
You can have that one for free.
That's good. You know, it's funny that the Decatur, and then for 1 year the Chicago Staleys. It's funny that George Halas's middle name is Staley, right? But that's a coincidence because it was A.E. Staley was the grain titan.
Is it Staley or is it Stanley? I always thought it was Stanley.
Is it George Stanley here? I mean, that's maybe one of those things that I just couldn't ever get straight for whatever.
Yeah, it's Stanley.
It is Stanley.
Well, the N is silent.
Thank you. Right. I'm going to call him Staley. I'm gonna ignore A.E. Staley, downstate grain magnet or whatever he was. Assign that to Papa Bear.
He was just some asshole who owned a grain elevator and had a little spare cash, and he sponsored a football team. I mean, it's funny how the NFL, like the Acme Packers and the Decatur Staleys, it would be like, it's like now going to get a sponsor for a softball team.
Right, company softball.
That's exactly what they were doing.
I know it was.
We were this close to having, to grabbing the Bears having to fly out to California to go play Chico's Bail Box.
That's a matchup I'd like to see with Walter Mann with Butterfinger in the dugout.
Butterfinger.
That's true.
Butterfinger's a different thing. Yeah. Well, now that they already have, which I think is the dumbest thing. Talk about a ridiculous sponsorship. You can sponsor a patch on their practice jerseys.
Like NASCAR? Oh, but on practice jerseys.
On Bears practice jerseys. How many people see that?
Right. The whole point of that would be exposure.
I mean, they're getting to the point where the NBA's got it. Baseball's been talking about it. You know, and if I was, if I had a lot of money, just to be fun, like I would, even if I did, I would pay to have somebody wear Chico's Bail Bonds on their jersey. Just because. Just if I had just enough money. I was like, this will be funny. Here's a patch. Here's your $4 million, whatever it is, for the season.
Right.
You're going to wear this patch.
Just burn it. I like it.
To me, there's a lot of parallels between the teams, and they're mostly bad. Greatest quarterback in Browns history?
So I actually did look this up. I've kind of had a little bit of a hobby in, and I don't have it mentally cataloged, but, you know, we already know that Jay Cutler just recently became the all-time Bears passer. But even then, he ranks down there. Oddly enough, Brian Sipe, who is the answer I know, is only about 400 yards more than Cutler. is right, because Cutler was like 23-7, 23 or 4-23, and I think Brian Sipe is 23-7, 23. That's a total parallel. And by the way, there's only one franchise whose all-time leading passer has fewer yards than Cutler, and it's Houston with Matt Schaub, and that's only like 300 yards.
Yeah, because the franchise is like 4 months old. Well,
that hasn't stopped, the Ravens.
Oh, we talked about it during one of the podcasts when they played the Texans last year? Yeah.
They did, yeah. And finally,
How Andre Johnson is their leading receiver and has like three times the receiving yards of Johnny Morris does.
Which, yeah, and so I think, too, that like it's kind of like you and I have talked about how much attention was paid to the Cubs having had a black hole at third base between Madlock and Ramirez, or some would say Santo and Bryant because they're morons, but really the greater hole has been center field. I'm not going to say this is greater than quarterback, but now that Cutler has actually, eclipsed Sid Luckman, it is so unbelievably absurd that the all-time leading in Bears receiving yards has just barely over 5,000 yards.
Yeah,
it's probably just barely alive.
Yeah, well.
I mean, not to be mean to old Johnny Morris, but like most teams' receivers have occurred in the last 20 years only, it seems. And even then, with that head start,
Bears. Well, my parallel was going to be Brian Sipe and Jay Cutler. Was going to Otto Graham and Sid Luckman.
Was Otto Graham this? Is he their second leading passer?
He's easily the greatest quarterback in Browns history.
Yes, for
sure. Just like Sid Luckman is still the greatest quarterback.
In Bears history. Even though Cutler, right? Well, so, because of the championships. Because statistically, Cutler's better. Obviously,
well, but than Luckman. You can't. I mean, I wasn't alive. I barely was alive to see Sid be alive, much less to see Sid play.
But he obviously had to be awesome because they dominated in one champ. Well, so I want to quickly just highlight that, how interesting it is there. We're going to make plenty of comparisons because we haven't even gotten to who the Browns wide receiver is, which is kind of equally embarrassing in some contexts.
Oh, I know it is.
Position, but I know.
And
it's not
a wide receiver.
But I know, which makes it kind of more embarrassing for them. But just to draw one positive comparison, the Bears won four. They went to the NFL in the 1940s, any decade beginning with four. Beginning in 1940, they won four championships in 7 seasons. They appeared in 5 championship games in 7 seasons. They were the class of the league, and the Browns were basically what the Bears were the next decade. They went to every championship out of the Eastern Conference from 1950 until 55. 6 years in a row, they went 3-3, just like the Bears. So very dominant there, and then of course, really neither team. Each franchise has each won one title since that era. But anyway, back to the Browns' all-time leading receiver, who's not even a wide receiver.
It's Ozzie Newsome.
Right.
He was a great player, but he should not be an all-time leading receiver.
Well, and imagine what a kick to the balls it is for Browns fans. And not only is it, he's a Hall of Fame tight end, so he's in that conversation with Ditka, John Mackey, Tony Gonzalez, all these modern guys, whatever. He's there. But Ozzie Newsome also is one of the Browns who remained loyal to Art Modell. Yeah. And it worked out for Ozzie, let's say, because he became the Ravens' general manager, I want to say, at least for their Super Bowl in 2000. Another kick to the nuts. So their beloved player, their all-time receiver, is like a complete Judas for them. I'm not ripping Ozzie. He seems like a good enough guy.
Yeah, well, so yeah, there's the parallels with the quarterback. There's parallels with the receiver. There's parallels that both teams have a very rich history that you have to be a historian to remember most of it or to enjoy most of it. The biggest difference is that Ernest Biner never played for the Bears. So they actually went to and won a Super Bowl where the Browns didn't get to go to theirs, although they probably would have got blown out in that Super Bowl. But
that's right. That's true.
So,
but
and then there's the other thing is when you look back at the history, I mean, I get the idea, right? All this stuff happened in Cleveland. But these aren't those Browns. Those Browns are the Ravens.
Not according to...
Other than the uniforms and the nickname, they started over. They've been terrible since they started over. They had this... It's funny because at the time, now it's perfect Browns, right? So the cat teams come into the league. the Panthers and the Jags, and they're both good too fast.
Yeah, both and go to the NFL, both go to the championship game in their second year, in their second season.
And so when now it's like, okay, we got to bring the Browns back
by themselves in 99.
All the rules so that that wouldn't happen again. They made it a million times harder for the Browns to build their team because they were like, well, no, we made the Jags and Panthers too good too fast. So they got screwed again to the point where when they brought the Texans in, they eased up the rules because, like, God, we really fucked the Browns. they're happy to have our team back. Well, no, you're not.
The Browns were the dead canary in the coal mine for, like, whatever adjustments they were trying to make.
I mean, really, what they got out of Art leaving was they got a new stadium that they don't seem to like, just like New Soldier Field.
Another parallel. Another parallel. Absolutely, you know,
the Factory of Sadness right down there on the river.
Factory of Sadness.
have you ever seen that video? The guy yelling at the stadium. Put it. At the
I may have.
It's one of the great.
Maybe if it's worthwhile, post.
Oh, it is.
One of
he's a comedian who is a big Brown fan, and he argues something about I shouldn't try to recreate this, I'll put it at the beginning, but basically, like, look, I know I'm not supposed to be complaining about football, because football is not as important as the things in life, but you are supposed to be a distraction from those things. Instead, you are a factory of sadness.
That's great. So basically expressing universal pain that a lot of us, especially those of us that have rooted for the Bears and the Cubs, and, you know, I think there are certain franchises in particular.
The biggest difference between the Bears and the Browns is that we can cling to 1985.
A Super Bowl. That's the
only
difference.
And they can't.
That's right.
Because theirs never happened.
That's it. And they've never, yep. They're one of those surprisingly strong number of there are high number of teams that are much more laughable than the Bears in the last 50 years and in just the whole span of the NFL. But even if you draw it to 50 years, we've got the edge on the Browns. The Browns and Lions are the only two NFL teams that existed before the merger that haven't played in the Super Bowl. I haven't looked that up, but it's got to be the case.
Yeah, because even the Cardinals went.
Yes, just once, but yeah, Cardinals have been slightly more competent. So,
man, that's a rough pill to swallow.
We'll get to that this year.
That'll
be a fun one. Okay, one other parallel in the positive direction again. So the negatives are. Well, and Cutler is the Bear. Basically, it's not from what era that is since Luckman's been passed. But the negative is that they have, I believe, two of the three lowest all-time passing yards, and they're probably the bottom two receiving yards, right? Because I don't think I completed my research, but I don't know of any other team that had their all-time leading receiver someone with fewer than 10,000 yards besides the.
I think it's I look because I was trying to.
Because Ozzie had like 8,000, right?
I don't 9, even know 000. If he got to 8. I get 7
okay,
or something.
Okay.
Yeah, they're the only two that are close to that low.
Another positive parallel is that they had two of the greatest running backs in the NFL. So there you go. It was Jim Brown's record that Walter Payton broke in 1984. So there's that. It is funny that
Jim Brown, the actor, he played football.
Jim Brown, the actor, yeah.
For the Dirty Dozen? I didn't even know
the
that.
The very one. In 48 hours, I think. I might have that wrong.
He's in Any Given Sunday, too.
Is that right?
I think Oliver Stone's going to make a football movie and not put Jim Brown in it. He's in Draft Day.
Oh,
him and Bernie Kosar both. They show up at the end.
Bernie Kosar. Well, there's another Brown. Yeah, well, that's why they brought it up, because it centers around
the
Browns.
So, you know, Jim Brown is, well, you have to say arguably, because somebody can argue about it, the greatest player of all time.
Who, oddly enough, never won a championship with the Browns, because Paul Brown won all those titles before he got Jim Brown. Brown had a great but short career, and then they won one more title with Leroy Kelly right after he retired. But yeah, no doubt, Brown only played 9 seasons.
One of the things I loved about Jim Brown was when it became clear to him it was inevitable that his record was going to get broken. It was either going to be by Franco or by Walter.
He openly was okay with Walter.
He openly rooted for Walter. because Franco ran out of bounds too much. He's like, I like Walter sticks guys.
Which as a Bear, we ate that up. Yeah. As a Bear fan, we ate that up because we love Walter so much. Speaking for me, I've talked about this at length, how much I resented running backs on other teams, even though I had nothing to be insecure about because Peyton was better, but I really resented high-profile running backs on good teams like Tony Dorsett and Franco. And I just luxuriated in Jim Brown completely coming down on Peyton's side during that. He was really kind of a dick about it, if you want to be objective about it. You know, I got nothing against Franco now, but Jim Brown was pretty big asshole to Franco, and he made no bones about it, which is kind of hilarious.
I'm sure the whole Steeler thing didn't hurt either. I said it, and I paused before I said it, the Browns are the greatest player of all time. I was thinking because when they did the NFL 100 greatest players, he was the greatest player. And
Brown was?
Yes. And Bill Belichick was, of course, he's the greatest football player ever. You know, a historian, me, I don't think he's the greatest football player of all time. I think Walter Payton is the greatest football player of all time. I think Jim Brown is the greatest running back of all time. And the distinction is Walter could do everything. And mainly because he played for the shitty Bears, he got to do almost everything.
True. Like, Ditka had him throw.
Do we think
passes.
Jim Brown could have led the NFL in punting? Because I'm pretty sure Walter could have.
Or he could have.
He could have played. Walter could have played wide receiver if he really needed.
Jim Brown was a track and field star at Syracuse.
Well, yeah,
but obviously, like running backs and linebackers are going to be your best athletes probably in the world to begin with. You're starting with that
at the time, given the era he played in. His size and speed combination was ridiculous.
Yeah,
when you watch films of that, it looks like. Why is the high school kid playing in the junior high game? I mean, Jim Brown is just crushing
everybody. And Peyton was not an outlier like that. Peyton's thing was different. So, Brown was almost more like a paradigm. Peyton is the best football player. And what's interesting, I know this is anecdotal because you can't measure it, but in doing my Paul Brown research, and Paul Brown, he obviously appreciated Jim Brown, but Paul Brown was also a bit of an autocrat. But it was pointed out that Paul Brown did get on Jim Brown for his unwillingness or inability to block. And we know, not say that about fucking Walter Payton. If want any proof, we talked about it last year. We covered Bears and Vikings, the Thursday night Jim McMahon game, where he comes off the bench and throws two touchdowns. Folks, look it up. It won't take you but a second if you haven't before. And either the first or second of the two touchdowns, there's a blitzing linebacker that's got a straight line to basically knock McMahon out for another 7 weeks, and Payton fucking picks him up and just takes him out of there.
When you watch it, it's amazing that he could get there. You don't think there's any chance that he could stop that guy from obliterating McMahon. And not only does he get there, he knocks that guy on his ass.
He did. He wiped him out of the play.
The guy never touches Jim. He goes from going to kill him to McMahon hardly even knows he was there.
Peyton wiped him out.
And that was not unusual for we remember it because it's famous. We don't remember because it's the only time he did it.
Correct.
Like, he did that shit all the time.
And I think that's why he ultimately earned Jim Brown's respect, because as a running back, he really would not only stay in for one more hit before getting knocked out of bounds, and he would never, like Franco, elect to go out of bounds before getting hit, but he would almost turn it on its head by himself being the aggressor and delivering the hit before, kind of being pushed out of bounds.
So a good example of that is, so last week, Joe Burrow did the thing where it's a pretty savvy move for a quarterback.
It was. And
he ran to the sidelines.
Astute for pointing it out.
And purposely stopped just on the white so that Robert Quinn would bump into him.
It was brilliant.
See Walter slow down by the sideline to get a defensive back to kind of let up, and then turn up the sideline and just knock that dude on his ass and get like 4 extra yards. It was like the opposite of Joe Burrow.
That's right. He would do that. That guy would fight for every goddamn last yard, man. And that's just him as a runner with the ball. He threw, like you said, partly because of the Bears' unimaginative offense, where they would try to bail themselves out by surprising defenses with a halfback option pass. He threw, 10 touchdowns, threw a lot of passes there, actually lined up under center under emergency circumstances, which we've talked about. He could punt. I don't know if he ever punted in a game on a quick kick or anything. But he could.
I think he did. So he must have, because we somehow knew he could punt.
Yeah, I know McMahon dropped a few third and 30-yard punts, but supposedly he could walk the punt. He did, in fact. One of my all-time favorite moments that I'm sure I've talked about
before. Jim McMahon's greatest insults ever. Theismann was criticizing him for punky QB shit, and he goes, I don't listen to criticism from guys who can't punt more than a yard.
love it. Too bad. Were we playing the Washington National Football Team this year? We can. I don't know if we are. I don't think we are. All right. Anyway, but it was said that Peyton could walk the distance of the football field all 100 yards on his hands.
Yeah.
Again, I mean, I don't like. You can go down that path, and Jim Brown was maybe just as good of an athlete, because Jim Brown was a triathlete. But Jim Brown, suppose he didn't block. We don't know what his receiving numbers were. He was kind of. I'm not going to knock Jim Brown, goddammit, because the gods will come get me. But he was a little bit, relative to Walter, kind of one-dimensional. He was a great running back. Give him the goddamn ball, and he's probably nobody better. But all around, it's just a football player, guy in the field that can have impact. You put Peyton ahead of Brown.
And it fits into the narrative we had last year with the Lions, where he just one day quit. Literally phoned it in from a – from a movie set, and said, "When come back?"
Was he one of the? I think we talked. Was he like one of the six youngest Hall of Fame? And he's got to be if he retired after nine seasons, right?
Yeah, I think. Pretty sure he was on that list.
He's got to be. You know, it's fun. Had he hung around, you know, he would have been on that 64 team, which remains the last championship that the Browns are in. And it was until the Cavaliers won in 2016, the last. Professional title in all four sports, or three sports in their case, for Cleveland since then. But that their 1964 is kind of what our 1908 was as Cub fans. And they haven't even made it back to the title game since then.
Jim Brown's second youngest.
After Gale.
After Gale, and just ahead of Butkus, Earl Campbell, and Barry Sanders.
So Earl and the two Bears were just beat up. And the other four...
Maybe they haven't updated this. Oh, and I haven't. Because Megatron, pretty high on that list, too.
I thought he was. But he's not a Hall of Famer yet. That's why.
No, he is. He just got inducted this year.
Ah, so
they haven't updated the list.
Okay.
Get on the shit, ProFootballHallOfFame.com.
We need to make our jokes.
There's a nice picture of Gale with his afro, though. So that makes sense.
Excellent. Excellent. So, yeah, the Bears and Browns head to head. Just to tie a bow on it all and kind of maybe set this up for some memories I'm sure we do have, because they did play each other. Some games spring to mind. But, yeah, they were different. When the Browns came over in the NFL 1950, of course, when they dominated this conference that Paul Brown helped start in 1946, the Browns' success almost itself basically ruined the league because they were so damn good. And, of course, they were so good that even though they were kind of like an expansion team or whatever, they dominated their conference in the NFL, which had been like the Giants' domain and later would be the Colts. But because they were in that other division, the Eastern Division, the Bears wouldn't regularly play them in the 50s and 60s. I don't know how the schedules worked then. They must have played a few times. You said they played 18 overall, so I don't know how many they would have played when they were both NFL teams. As opposed to being, interconference opponents, which, as we know, can only happen nowadays every 4 years.
I ask this every week. What year was the merger?
The merger was 1970, is the first official year. So the Browns were an NFL team in 69, but then an AFC team. So they're always an NFL team, but they were.
Oh, right.
It became an AFC team in 1970.
Yeah, so they played.
There'll be some parallels there between the Steelers, too, when we cover them.
They played in 69.
So that was just a chance intradivisional NFL pre-merger.
Browns beat the Bears 28-24.
Was that at Soldier Field or.
That was at
Municipal.
No, 69.
Or, I'm sorry, Wrigley Field.
Was that Soldier Field?
Sorry. Wrigley Field,
correct. Oh, I didn't. So the Soldier Field thing, they
1971.
So the NIU Husky marching band got to play at halftime.
I saw that
because they were the first collegiate marching band ever to play in Soldier Field for a Bear game.
In 1971?
1975.
So they didn't have any bands.
What the hell did they do for the first 4 years? I thought halftimes back then were all high school bands or some shit.
I'm guessing it was bleak as shit.
Or it was.
And no frills. Halas finally got it. Thought he was getting into more seats.
I think Vag and Ed would come down and play bridge. Play a hand of bridge.
No,
who won, and then Ed would sing.
Ed would put on a cabaret show. Yeah. Right? He would tickle the ivories, as it were. And
but yeah, so, because they're celebrating
some Cole Porter.
It's funny that they're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Bears at Soldier Field while the Bears are actively trying to get out of their lease.
Right. And they had already had to, sink money into redeveloping. Because the old place was such a fucking dump. It's funny to think that they didn't have any frills, not even the most basic, not even like the Lane Tech marching band coming down. I got to ask my dad. I do know that, and I was telling a fellow this yesterday that I was at the Cubs game and I was sitting next to a fellow that grew up in Bloomington, Minnesota, and worked at the Metropolitan Stadium, and he would watch the Vikings and all that stuff. And I was going into the history of the Bears and my dad's perspective, having been a season ticket holder for about 12 years at Wrigley Field in the upper deck, along third base, which was perfect, I think, to watch football. You're a little bit above to be thrown into this oasis on the southeast side in this cavernous track stadium with no amenities and apparently no marching band, nothing around the stadium, which eliminated the ritual that my dad and his buddies would have pregame and, meeting up. It was just, it was a sort of a violent, uprooting. And he would talk about it for years. Like, as a kid, I was like, hey, the Bears were great in the 80s. I love going to Soldier Field. I couldn't recognize objectively what a dump it was. But I was always surprised that my dad would talk so negatively about it and wistfully about Wrigley Field. But now I get it. They didn't. Like, those games must have been so depressing because they were a bad team, too, in the early 70s.
I mean, when you think about it, how did it make any sense that the state and the state basically built Comiskey Park? And they didn't build it for both teams.
Because, I don't know.
Well, because nobody wanted to share a stadium.
Well,
that's why they didn't do it. But the whole idea is if the state's going to build it, there ought to be more than one fucking team in it. Otherwise, Jerry should pay for it himself.
Well, what's funny is that there was a trend of all those cookie-cutter stadiums in the 70s that Richie Hebner once said, you're at home plate and you don't know if you're in Philadelphia, St. Yep. Louis, Cincinnati, or Pittsburgh. And they were multi-use stadiums, had no charm. But Comiskey was always considered the last of those types of stadiums before Camden Yards. So it is curious that if they were still going to go with that mammoth design, why they didn't do that. I mean, I guess maybe the McCaskies and Reinsdorfs weren't aligned.
Well, neither one of them wanted to share. It would have been a quick conversation. It wouldn't have been hard to convince them to say no. You don't want to do this, do you? No. Okay, good. I don't either. Yeah, because the last duel, somebody posted a picture of the last time we'll see the cutout of a baseball field on a football field, and that was 2 years ago when the Raiders left. And the Raiders, part of the reason why the A's need a new stadium is the Raiders completely fucked that place up. They have that whole weird, huge thing they built in center field. They call it Mount Davis. It's just this huge skybox, nailed onto the side of it.
Is that a colloquialism, or is it officially, did somebody officially call it Mount
Davis? No, the A's bitch about it and call it Mount Davis because it ruined a big part of their park.
Pejorative. That's what Raiders do, right?
Yep, that's right. Just living up to the nickname.
way to play to the part. So how many times did the Bears and Browns play before 69? How many more times? It's fewer than five.
It's five.
They're both
51, 54, 60, 61, and 67.
Interesting. Okay.
And so the Browns won four out of the five.
Okay, yeah, Bears were mostly bad. Browns were still pretty good. Browns are really good, up until the merger, really, I think.
Bears got it close a few times, though.
It's hardly in 64.
They lost 39-10 and 42-0 and 24-0.
Wow.
A big offensive outpouring in 51. They lost 42-21.
Wow.
Yeah, they didn't just lose. They got their ass kicked. This rivalry up until – actually, the Bears are very good against the new Browns.
Okay,
they were not good against the old Browns. They were 8-3 against the old – or 3-8 against the old Browns.
Okay. Before we finish with the new Browns, or I don't know which direction we're going, but I do have a memory. The Bears' very first game after their Super Bowl – Soldier Field, yep. September 1986. And this is why I remember this. I was watching it, of course. And as we've talked about before, the Bears always started off 4-0, 5-1, 4-1, you know, for years around the Super Bowl. And it was also the first season of a real instant replay system, which we talked about this last year. And I remember finding a very insightful article. I can't remember who wrote it, and I can find it again, that had the whole history of instant replay that kind of filled in the gaps for me, although I just can't remember them again. It actually, they played around with it in preseason games going back to the 70s. But 1986 was really the first time instant replay was going to happen. And honest to God, the Browns get the ball to start the game, to start the 86 season. So there are like maybe 7 or 8 games taking place across the country. And they go, I want to say they go 3 and out. And on 4th down, the punt sails over the punter's head. There's mayhem. They kick it out. Nobody knows what's going on. And 4 plays into the new instant replay era, the very first. And this is not like in any way even almost related to today's instant replay. They had instant replay for a while until shortly after the Bears got screwed by it in 1991, and then it disappeared for a while. I can't remember when it came back. They've modified it, made it better, and it was really antiquated. But the very first play to be reviewed in an official capacity on instant replay in an NFL game was the Bears-Browns opening day 1986.
So the Bears fumbled.
Was it the Bears that?
Yes.
It might have been the Bears.
Yeah. Here's why. This is great. So the scoring summary of the first score of the 1986 season is a gross fumble recovery in the end zone, Matt Barr kick, because the guy's name apparently was Al Gross.
It's
but
a
they
gross
abbreviated it to a gross fumble recovery.
That's great.
But this is perfect Browns. So the Browns take a 7-0 lead. They're excited. Woo, here we go. You know what happened when they kicked off?
Nope.
Pinky ran it back 91 yards for a touchdown to tie the game.
I don't remember that. That's great.
Yeah.
Good old Dennis Gentry.
And,
Bears, I think, went going
Walter
away.
Had right? Walter, 2-yard touchdown run. And then Wilbur Marshall, 58-yard interception return for a touchdown to end the quarter. It was 21-7 at the end of the quarter.
Yeah.
But remember we talked last year about the weird 85 Bears Bucks game early in the season where the Bucks scored 35 points against the Bears.
They scored 28 all in the first half.
Okay.
Yep, and the Bears won 38-28.
First
yep.
game of the 86 season, Browns scored 31 points. Yep. Or I guess only 24 of them on offense, but
that's right, but still.
Still. That was like a
Well, I think I don't
couldn't
know
blame that on Buddy.
And the Browns, they were actually a good team that year. Oddly enough, this is a rarity in the modern era. It's still old Browns, not new Browns, because I don't think this has ever happened.
Well, it's Bernie Kosar.
Well, the year before, they were a weak sister NFC Central winner against a weak NFC, and they went to the playoffs and very narrowly knocked off the Dolphins in a divisional game. It was a great game. I remember Don Rogers, who eventually dropped dead a few weeks after Len Bias, had some big plays in this game. When we were made aware of the athletes in crack, but they were not considered like a real good team, but they won a watered down division, almost upset the Dolphins, and the next year they did go to the title game, and this was the season in which the Browns actually got closer to the Super Bowl than the defending champion Bears.
Yep.
And had the famous 7-point lead with 2 minutes to go at home. Not the fumble, that was the
next
year.
Oh, that's right.
Year,
this is the drive year.
The drive was 86. And that happened in Denver, but they had – no, it happened in Cleveland. And that was the thing. Elway was backed up to his – he was backed up to his, like, 4. And there are all those, sausage eaters are going nuts with, like, plastic pig snouts on their face. And Elway just shoved it up their ass. And the next year it was actually in Denver on the road when Beiner fumbled. So in back-to-back years, the Browns lost to the Broncos in the title game in heartbreaking fashion, back-to-back years. It's pretty rough. And then coincidentally, when Elway insisted on getting humiliated for his 3rd straight Super Bowl following the 89 season, a Browns team, this time coached by Bud Carson, whereas Marty Schottenheimer had coached those 86 and 87 teams, was also Denver's last stop in the title game. So what is it, 3 out of 4 years, the Browns were knocking on the door to the Super Bowl, only to have it answered by a horse-faced quarterback who would face his own humiliation 2 weeks later. So that was kind of their only, their last golden era, right, of Browns won.
Yeah.
Except for Bill Belichick was a, their last coach in Browns won, right?
Yes.
And their last playoff team.
And
the coach when they left town.
That was a coaching staff that had Bill Belichick and Nick Saban on it.
That's so Cleveland. Yeah. Yeah, the greatest –
greatest pro football pro, coach, the greatest college football coach on the
coaching
same,
at the same our, time. They're on the same. They're fired coaching
one,
at the same time.
Fired one for no good reason other than the fact that Art didn't like him.
Is that and, Belichick?
Yeah, and then didn't hire. Could have replaced him with Nick Saban. I didn't do that. Either.
Now, in defense of, I guess, Art Modell, Belichick was a decent coach, but he was kind of a guy at, then still, I think, in most people's eyes.
Yeah, but I don't. I doubt he got. Did he get so much better that when he got his Patriots job that all of a sudden he knew his shit? I have a feeling that you should have been able to tell, I think.
That, well, none of it mattered. But none of it mattered because once Modell pulled the plug in 95, and the Bears and the Browns should have otherwise played that year. I don't think they did because the Bears played the AFC Central, but I think that was because Jacksonville joined the league and – for scheduling purposes, they took the Browns off. The Bears lost the Browns in 92. I remember watching that game, but I don't think they played in 95, but I remember how depressing it was that Modell announces that they're moving. They had, you know, fan support, but Modell couldn't get a new stadium and whatever. You look it up if you're not familiar with all the tragedy of the Cleveland fans getting their team, you know, taken from them. But because it was announced during the season, the fans like stopped going and advertisers took their bill. It was like really almost like this post-apocalyptic scene at Cleveland Stadium.
Well, the last,
for the last
game,
couple
they,
months of 95.
They were tearing seats out of the thing, throwing some on the field and keeping other ones. And
yeah, it was just a weird thing. And that, I get, you're right. That closes the chapter on the Cleveland Browns, even though logically and how the Major League Baseball and the NFL had always done it up until then. They followed, you know, the record should have followed to Baltimore, but because the outrage was so strong, the league decided to basically treat Baltimore as a expansion franchise. And I don't know if the decision was made right away, but the Browns, the current Browns, as you've mentioned a couple times, are technically an expansion team, but somehow the NFL has like allowed the record keeping.
It happened
to,
because of
resume.
It, ironically, it happened because of Baltimore. When the Colts went to Indianapolis, there was a lot of talk after the fact that they should not have been allowed to take the Colts logo and records with them. It should have started over in Indianapolis. So their next chance to actually do that was the Browns.
Coincidentally.
So that's why they basically had made the decision then that if an established team moves, they have to leave their records. So in a couple of years, when the Arlington Heights Ponies start to play, the Bears will cease to exist until some expansion team moves into Soldier Field 3.
That's fun. Well, because, yeah, now they've gotten carried away with it because I don't follow the NBA like I used to. But isn't there, like, all right, correct me if I'm wrong. I know you follow the NBA much more than I do. But I'm trying to follow. Are there still Charlotte Bobcats? There's a whole, like, what's the deal with, like, New Orleans? There's something about a,
right. So
there was an NBA interruption like that. And they really played fast and loose with the
Hornets moved Rockets. To New Orleans, and they started off as the Hornets. And then they rebranded, and they became the Pelicans. And then Charlotte got an expansion team, and they became
the Bobcats.
They became the Bobcats for the greatest reason ever. Bob Johnson, the guy who owned Black Entertainment Television, he was the opposite of Paul Brown. He named the team after himself. They were the Bobcats because his name was Bob.
And the Bobcats, which makes it worse. Yes. It's just like, yeah,
and nobody
the
liked nobody liked the nickname or whatever. So when they sold to the group that eventually handed the keys over to Jordan, they asked and they were allowed by the NBA to bring the Hornets back.
So the branding, the merchandise, the records, and all that stuff for bookkeeping purposes.
Right. They started over. Hornets 1 are in New Orleans. Hornets 2 are in Charlotte.
But so from like, a records perspective.
So like Larry Johnson, for all intents and purposes, is a Pelican. If you looked up his records, he's not.
If they followed it like how baseball's always done it.
Right. Rex Chapman started off for the Pelicans, even though he never set foot in New Orleans.
Got it. But that's not how they keep it, though.
No, he's in the Pelicans record book. He's not in the Hornets record book.
Okay.
All they got was the uniforms back. They're still the.
Okay.
Just to make things really confusing.
Yeah, Jesus.
But the NBA has the greatest example of why you should force teams to rebrand.
Utah Jazz.
Right, when the New Orleans Jazz moved to Utah and became the Utah Jazz.
Well, and let's be frank, the Los Angeles Lakers.
Right, same.
I mean, they're by a body of water, but they're from the Great Lakes in the land of 10,000 lakes. So, So that. So what? I think that we can close the chapter on Browns 1.
Yeah.
They kind of went out.
Because Browns 2 has two great games in Bears history.
They do. Oh, that's right. Well, I'm thinking of one right away. I'm not sure of the second one.
Yeah. But it second was the one is, second one, let's say the Bears avoided something more than they did something. Yeah, of course, the one, I think the game you're thinking of is the one I immediately thought
it's
of.
It's 01.
November 4th, 2001 in Soldier Field.
The same day that the Arizona Diamondbacks would win the World Series in walk-off fashion. Just wanted to connect those because I remember it was a very big sports day. And it was insane. It was the first time the Bears and Browns 2 were to play because the Browns 2 came back in 99 and 01 was when the divisions would play each other. And they were actually pretty good in the third year. And they were pretty good early in that season.
They were 4-2 coming into the game. The Bears were 5-1.
And Butch Davis was their coach, was he not?
I believe so.
Miami Hurricane coach, and the Browns actually continued to ascend after that season until they did make the playoffs, I think, around 03, 04, 05. But in 01, this game kind of spiraled them, as it could, but it was the game that most Bear fans would remember was the game that ended in the exact same fashion as the week before.
But it's even more ridiculous because the Bears trailed 21-7. With 28 seconds to go in the game.
Even back up, if you're looking, are you looking at the game, go back where it was 21-7 and the Bears had the ball, the possession before, and went for it on fourth down, like inside the 10, and didn't get it. And it was like, oh, this game's over. Like they had a legitimate shot earlier than the last possession, and it didn't, and they had to go for it on fourth because that's how it was probably under 2 minutes, but they did manage to get the ball back. Wait, it was 21-7, right, with 28 seconds, but they had another crack. Shane, and our guy Shane Matthews right?
Game of his life, threw a 9-yard touchdown pass to Marty Booker. Bears recovered the onside kick, and with no time remaining, as you would expect, he threw a touchdown pass to his halfback in the end
zone.
Where James Allen caught it, broke some tackles, and ran in. He caught it in the end zone.
Little guy. Laying on his back, too, sort of, I think, right? I'll never forget that. Obviously, it was absolutely bonkers. And that was just to tie the game.
Yes.
But it was – so that's just getting an onside kick and a Hail Mary. Sometimes you get an onside kick – and you have enough time to get four plays, like it's a backbreaker. But it was like onside kick, and we only have time now to launch the ball up. It was like two almost consecutive, right? I mean, I don't know if there were any plays between the onside kick and the Hail Mary. Probably maybe one or two, but I don't think they had. If they're 28 seconds when they scored the
Well, it had to be at least one because I don't think they got the onside kick at the Browns 34.
No, okay,
so you're not allowed to advance.
That's right.
The onside kick if you're the kicking team.
So they made a play and somehow got the clock stopped.
Well, they just rode Shane's big arm.
Yeah. Shane was okay in 01. He started them. Miller took over. And he also showed up at a Circuit City on Elston Avenue, and I happened to be there for some other reason and decided to get in line and get my black and white glossy signed and gave him a fist bump, which seemed kind of new at the time. Yeah. Shane was down with it. Shane. That's a whole separate conversation, the 2001 Bears, but that was just that was obviously when they beat the Browns. Well, we didn't finish the reenactment.
Right,
but,
so the week before, this was the second one, right? This is the second of the two?
Another thrilling comeback. Not as instantaneous, but...
Well, the week before we had the satisfaction of Mike Brown taking the ball off of Terrell Owens' hands.
Absolutely.
And returning it for the walk-off touchdown.
Because Tio thought that Urlacher was going to take his fucking head off, which I think he was.
He was.
But that game was also a ridiculous comeback because the Bears needed two touchdowns and two-point conversions. They were actually down 16 points with, you know, it's maybe 5 minutes left or whatever. And Matthews was the quarterback in that game. And it was one of the only times I remember David Terrell, who was a rookie and sucked ass and dropped the ball later against Detroit, but would absolutely have a huge catch in that game. But it was like that was more of a drawn out, thrilling comeback, whereas the Cleveland one was a little more stunning because you were actually like, this game's over.
Yeah.
But yeah, Mike Brown catches that ball in the air that T.O. tapped up because he was afraid of getting hit by Urlacher. Brown runs it in for the walk-off. Flash forward a week. We get the onside kick, the Hail Mary. We're going to overtime again. Cleveland's got the ball. Was it Tim Couch?
Tim Couch.
Quarterback?
God damn right it was Tim Couch.
The first pick in New Browns history. But yeah, so... What happens in the second consecutive overtime, Andy?
Mike Brown, 16-yard interception return for a touchdown, and the game is over.
It's just so nuts when you think about how nuts is that we saw that.
But you know, it's the part that's not crazy is, you know, if the Bears needing quick strike touchdowns, and you know, the week before needing two-point conversions, who better to draw that stuff up than famed Bears offensive coordinator John Shoup?
Yes. The Bears did go to the playoffs with John Shoup as their offensive coordinator. Yes, they did. So what's the other Browns Bears? That's all I got for Browns, too, because I'm thinking, all right, 05, they would have been scheduled to play. That was the game that they lost when they started off 1-3, right before or right after Chad Johnson humiliated Urlacher. 09, I don't have a memory. 013, I think they had a must-win with Mark Trestman down the stretch, and they got it in December against them. So that was a win. 2017 was John Fox, so I blacked out. So
that's
what's the other game you're talking about?
That's 2017? The big game. Because it was week 16, and the Bears were hosting the 0-14 Cleveland Browns. And the Browns, looking at their schedule, this was their chance to avoid going 0-16. And the mighty John Fox, it was only 6-3 at halftime, Bears. But in the third quarter, Jordan Howard, a 16-yard run, and Mitchell Trubisky ran for a 4-yarder. The Bears won 20-3, leaving only the Pittsburgh Steelers in the way. The Steelers, who had already clinched a playoff spot, started Landry Jones at quarterback, and they beat the Browns, and the Browns won 0-6.
I'd forgotten the Browns duplicated the 2008 Lions, is so perfect.
But even better, the year after, they went 1-15. Is that right?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, Hugh Jackson. We're going to get to Hugh here in a second. We're going to go through the coaches.
Hugh Jackson is like climbing up the Ken Venturi ladder if he was actually the coach through the entirety of both of those seasons.
Yeah, Hugh was their coach when they went 1-15 and their coach when they went 0-16.
Ouch.
But another, he had a much more successful season, salvaged his record. He also went 1-14-1.
Holy
shit. Scratch that.
Oh,
I shortchanged him.
Different team.
2-13-1. Okay. Hugh Jackson career record with the Bengals, winning percentage of 0.88, 3-36-1.
Oh my God! Wow. Yeah. Has he coached since then?
No. He coached the Raiders before it, not after it.
I've always found it interesting that he spells his name H-U-E, like the color, or like my nickname, which comes from my last name of Donahue, as opposed to H-U-G-H.
Oh, he could be Irish.
He could be. Him and Shaq. Huh.
So the Browns have a lot of famous coaches. They're, of course, their winningest coach is
Paul Brown. Right?
Yeah, 158 wins, 48 losses, 8 ties. Lots of people like to ties.
He is their Hallis.
He won 4 AAFC championships, 46, 47, 48, 49. 3 NFL championships, 50, 54, and 55.
He is totally their Hallis.
He won 7 NFL conference championships, 50 to 55 and 57, whatever the hell that is.
Yep.
He was the coach of the year 4 times.
Yeah.
And he was succeeded by their second winningest coach in Browns history. Do you know who that is?
I don't offhand. Would I know the name?
You will recognize the name. I doubt you'd be able to picture him because I can't. Blanton Collier.
No, I don't even recognize the
76,
name.
76, 34, and 2.
Yeah.
He took them to the playoffs 7 times.
By the way, I just want to say that my dad would use it as an argument against Jim Brown that Leroy Kelly led the league in rushing in his first year in the NFL, apropos of nothing. Disregard the fact that Neil Anderson fared rather well beginning in 1988. Carry on.
I did not know this. Maybe you knew this because he won Coach of the Year there. You know Forrest Gregg coached the Browns?
What?
75 to 77. He was 18 and 23, but he was the NFL Coach of the Year in 1976.
Wow.
So that was pre-Bengals. So he went Browns, Bengals, Packers.
Yes.
I knew Bengals,
Packers. So he somehow wormed his way into Paul Brown's favor. Somehow. Yeah. He was an SMU guy. He was a Texan. So I wonder. Interesting. All right. Well, I learned something there. Forrest Gregg.
Forrest was followed by...
Sam Ratigliano. Yeah, that's the first coach I remember. Really likable guy. And then we see him years later coaching at Liberty. Like, oh, he's a wacko. But I always felt bad for him because those are the Brian Sipe teams. And, I don't know, maybe it's my nature being a Cubs fan and, like rooting for the underdog or whatever. But the Steelers were still kind of a menace even into the early 80s, I think. And they were, and the Browns just couldn't get past them. But of course, really famously, they had a playoff game. And we talk about like the Minnesota Vikings having some real nut crushing playoff losses, but under Sam Rutigliano and Brian Sipe, all time franchise passing leader, they had a playoff game, a divisional playoff game against the Raiders, who I believe ended up winning the Super Bowl. I believe it was the 1980 season. They were in the red zone and were only trailing, I think, by 2 points, maybe 14 to 12 or 16 to 14. So game's over, and Brian Sipe got intercepted in the end zone. Just had to get that on the record because it came to me. But that was under the great Sam Rutigliano.
So Sam has an odd distinction where he was the NFL Coach of the Year twice, and he has a losing record in his time in Cleveland. So the early years must have been bad.
He was there for a while if he succeeded Greg in the late 70s, because I didn't even
start 78 following. To 84.
Yeah, that's a long time.
So 70.
Because Schottenheimer came after him, I believe.
Yep. There's a gleam.
There's a gleam.
That's one of his weird pre-game speeches that the NFL films like to show.
I always thought he kind of looked a little bit like Larry King back in the 80s, but I don't know. On the sidelines, those big old 1980s style Sally Jesse Raphael glasses. He was the guy, but Marty was the guy that took them to those, at least back-to-back AFC championship games in which they had their heart ripped out.
Man, he was 44 and 27.
Winning coach.
He won 2 playoff games. They were 2-4 in the playoffs. They went to the playoffs 4 times. And he was the – they won 3 straight Central Division champions.
85. 86,
and he was the coach of the year in 1986.
Yeah. Yeah, 86 was their best shot. It wouldn't have mattered, again, because you and I have spent so much time talking about this, we should probably write a book about the absolute singular dominance of the NFC in the 1980s, which, the Bears only get a seat at that table because their one season was so spectacular, but it was really the Redskins, Giants, and 49ers. Bears were kind of right there, and then even the Rams and Vikings were okay. So it wouldn't have mattered, really, now that I think about it. Fort 30 years later had, you know, they stuffed Elway in 86 or Beinerhead or 86 or Beinerhead and a fumbled in 87 because their fate could have been worse than what Denver endured. But they were, you know, 86 was their best shot at making the Super Bowl, either Browns 1 or Browns 2. I mean, if Browns 2 even won a playoff game, they may have. They've made the playoffs since 1999.
They won one last year. They beat the Steelers.
Oh. And they, okay. I wonder if they had, did they have one? Okay.
It's well, their good only for them. One. They have only been to the playoffs twice since they were Browns, too.
Oh, my God.
They so went they once. Like the, Butch took them the, in 1 year, and that was it.
Holy shit. I'm looking at it now. So new Browns are like, even if you look at that in a vacuum, as sad as the last 25, 30 years, and it wasn't even that sad. The Browns history is actually just so much distinctly worse in the last 20 seasons. I hadn't even really grasped that.
Well, here's a good way to put it into perspective. They have had, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. They've had 6 non-interim coaches, some of whom have coached multiple seasons, who have fewer than 10 career victories with the Browns.
That's
6.
Incredible. Since 1999, since Browns 2.
Yep. It starts with the first one they ever had. The great, I'm sure he's the son of Brad Palmer, the professor, Chris Palmer. Yeah, so after Schottenheimer, they had Bud Carson for 2 years, went to the playoffs once.
He took him to the title game and lost to Denver again.
He apparently quit or got whacked during the 90s
season. He
gave way
to Belichick, right?
Well, Jim Schaffner was the interim, and then Belichick took over.
Yeah,
and Bill, they were 36-44 in his 80 games, but they won the last playoff game they would win for a very long time.
In 94.
And then they were gone. They drafted Ray Lewis and whisked him off to Baltimore.
Oh, that's a great trivia fact.
Drafted as a Brown, never played for the
Browns. Drafted as a Brown. Wow. I'm still recovering from the fact that it was not a mirage to see that the Browns team that the Bears came back on in 2001 was actually a good Browns team, even though they were only in their third year of their post-expansion existence. They did, in fact, make the playoffs next year. And then you're right. It was freaking 18 years, and it required this COVID-enabled expand, although they were legitimately good last year, and they are now, but they, you know, last year was their first playoff appearance in 18 seasons. So they basically, outside of that anomaly of a playoff appearance in their third season, is just immediately began setting new marks in futility.
Well, and it's funny, if you look at the psychology of the Browns, Butch Davis gets them turned around, and then they fire him. Yeah. And when Butch was on their ascendancy is when the Patriots under Belichick started to kick everybody's ass. So
they'd already won a couple.
So their next two hires after they fire Butch are Parcells' assistant coaches, Romeo Crennel, and then Eric Mangini. They're basically trying to replicate the success that they thought they would have had they had A, their team not left, and B, they not fired Bill Belichick.
Right. Because Belichick, pre-expansion, pre-relocation, was the Browns coach. Okay. the hits keep on coming for Browns fans here. Yeah.
So Romeo was 24-40.
Okay.
The man genius went 10-22.
Who he himself was on his second stab because he had been the Jets coach the year the Bears.
And it is funny because there are still people who will cape for Mangini, saying that the Jets shouldn't have fired him. He actually was a good coach. That his biggest problem was he has terrible people skills.
Okay.
That he's a good coach, but he has terrible people skills. He also has a terrible lisp, which was what made it hysterical when ESPN hired him. I'm like, what are you gonna do? Dub him? It's gonna be like watching a Godzilla movie, and Eric's mouth is gonna move, and somebody's gonna yell his lines from behind.
The first thing I think of with Eric Mangini, and we're not playing the Jets this year, so I'll save it, or I should save it, but I'm not, is the year the Bears went to the Super Bowl, they played the Jets. Mangini was their coach. Bears were very good that year. They beat him, I think, 10-3, but Mangini tried to surprise the Bears by making an onside kick to begin the second half. Failed, and I think that was when the Bears threw the 60-yard touchdown to Mark Bradley and won. So that's the first thing I think of. But that was before he was the Browns coach.
But you're the one doing the Sopranos rewatch. Have you?
I am.
Have you gotten to the episode yet where the, I don't even know who it is. Is this, I don't know if it's Paulie. Somebody calls him the Man Genius.
Yes.
Which, I mean, was his nickname, but it was hysterical to hear it during a Sopranos.
Yes. I've re-binged the Sopranos once. I'm actually listening to the Talking Sopranos podcast with Michael Imperioli and Steve Sciarrippa. They did come across that episode, and they did reference that you're absolutely right, that Paulie made that reference. Yeah, I mean, because, you know, Sopranos was on between 99 and 07, and it was towards the end because Mangini was their coach in 05 and 06, I think, 06, 07. But he shows up. I mean, I don't even recognize some of these coaches. I mean, part of that's me becoming more disinterested.
Well,
you know the next guy.
You know Pat Shurmur. Is he Fritz's
kid? Yeah, I know the
kid.
Name. Oh, okay.
He was the coach of the Giants. He was an offensive coordinator for the Vikings. And yes, he's currently Vic Fangio's offensive brain in Denver.
He's a lifer. I did recognize the name.
And there was
Rob Chudzinski, former
tight end. And Mike Pettin is currently, Pettin. He's not on the coaching staff. He's a special assistant to Matt Nagy, which I'm sure the reason he is when he was the defensive coordinator of the Packers, he outcoached the shit out of Nagy's offense 4 times in 2 years. Like, literally made adjustments. On our old podcast, Kyle lost his shit one night. We couldn't hear him, I'm sure, because his internet was crapping out. Lost his shit about how Pettin is not that good a defensive coordinator, and that's proof that Nagy's a moron because he could never readjust to anything that Pettin did.
How depressing.
So they get rid of Pettin, and then they immediately think, oh, shit, maybe we shouldn't have, because that's when Hugh walks in. And,
oh my God. That is Venturi-esque. I'm looking at it. 15-4. He was the coach. He 0-16, 1-31, 4-44. Oh, no, Pettin was the coach for their 3-13 team. Yep. And Jackson got whacked halfway through the 2018 season, where they apparently turned it around with some coach, Williams, who they didn't keep on.
Some coach. So that's Greg Williams, double G, Greg.
The headhunter.
Yes, bounty.
The bounty hunter.
The bounty hunter who had to serve a suspension.
He's the Joey Pants of of Midnight Run.
Yeah, and
he's paying the bounty hunters, I should say.
He was the defensive coordinator last year for the Jets when they were going to win their first game, and he called an all-out blitz against the Raiders, and the Raiders threw like a 70-yard touchdown pass on what would have been the second-to-last play of the game to beat him. He got fired for that, but people are like, Adam Gase fired him, the great Adam Gase. Or like, okay. I thought you guys were trying to lose to get Trevor Lawrence.
Well, yeah, Greg Williams took that team. I just have to jump on this because I happen to see it just going down the rabbit hole. But Greg Williams, as a head coach in that 28 for the 2018 Browns team, he went 5-3, turned it around. You'd think, but Hugh Jackson, he went 2-5-1, and I only bring that up because Hugh Jackson was coming off an 0-16 season and a 1-15 season. How in the world was 2-5-1 not an improvement? Like, why did they decide to fire him then?
So the thing you have to remember about 2018, the Browns were on Hard Knocks. And Hugh, the whole world got to see what a moron he was.
Okay, but
it immediately put him under, like, I'm sure there was pressure to fire him during Hard Knocks.
Did they need HBO to point out that
they,
a guy no,
they
gone
needed
1-30,
HBO to make it
gone,
public knowledge?
But
that
he'd gone 1-31 as a coach. You have to almost make that assumption.
And so that Hard Knocks is amazing. The offensive coordinator at the beginning of Hard Knocks was Todd Haley. You remember Todd?
Oh yeah, a little bit of a psychopath.
Yeah, then Greg Williams was the defensive coordinator, and then Bob Wiley, old Bear offensive line coach, was. And, you know, he has this huge gut, and he was doing all this weird stuff. And he was saying to one of the players, I don't know why we do all this stretching. Have you ever see a lion stretch before it goes to chase?
He's one of those guys.
Yeah, he's one of those dumbasses. So then they bring in Greg, And he's just as nuts. And they go 5-3 to finish it. But Freddie Kitchens was, he became the offensive coordinator when they fired Todd Haley.
At that point, it had been their best record since 2007, 7-8-1.
So
okay, go on.
The owner was convinced that because the thing that turned around that season was really the offense under Baker.
Oh, okay.
And the idea was we're going to pair Baker with his offensive coordinator. Well, early on in the 2019 season, when Freddie takes over, Baker gets quoted as saying that they pull out a quote from Hard Knocks from the year before where he called Freddie an idiot. And Baker played it off was, we were just joking around. I called him an idiot, like, hey, don't be an idiot. You know, not like, you're an idiot. There's a difference. Well, Freddie was an idiot. So Freddie got fired. And then they brought in, but they could tell they were starting they had all those draft picks.
This is actually
starting
the
stockpile talent.
This is the origin story of the team that actually right now, unusually and unexpected, or it should be overdue, but is actually a really good team.
Yes.
Right.
And so then they hired Kevin Stefanski from the Vikings.
Yep. And they finally fucking turned it around.
And now they're
because, you know, if you're looking at the franchise encyclopedia, you're seeing something that you don't see with the Browns and you don't see it with the Bears, is left to right, the season leader, passer, rusher, receiver. When you see, like, you know, Jim Kelly, Thurman Thomas, Andre Reed, or Troy Aikman, Emmitt Smith, Michael Irvin, like, you know, for 5-6, that's when, you know, and you're seeing Mayfield, Chubb, and Landry 3 years in a row this year. So I got Njoku is currently their leading receiver, but yeah, they've got something going on after all the laughs we've just had at their expense and feeling better about our own sorry ass franchise, considering like the disruption of their existence and just their general woefulness. Coincidentally enough, this franchise might actually be doing some shit.
All right, so I should have looked at these at the notes because these are pretty good. Forrest Gregg got fired with one game to go in the 77 season. Basically, get out of here. Go away. And then he went to coach.
All right. I was coach of the year.
Sam Ratigliano got fired 8 games in the 84 season, and his interim coach was Marty Schottenheimer.
You're just making me jealous, by the way, more franchises that have
interim
had multiple elusive interim coaches.
Oh, no, the Bears will never have had. That's why the whole idea, if you're going to spend money on Matt Nagy to be the first coach fired, just take that money and light it on fire.
Yeah, no.
That's not
okay.
Happening.
So interesting that Marty Schottenheimer, like Wayne Fonts, which makes it a little bit harder to detect immediately, went from interim coach to full-time coach and was actually one of their more successful ones. But I didn't know that he replaced Rutigliano midseason. All right.
Butch Davis quit 11 games into the 2004 season. I don't know where he ran off to coach North Carolina.
Which
I guess
almost,
where he ended up.
Almost Bobby Ross-like, because they were coming off some rough times, but he'd taken them to the playoffs 2 years earlier. All right.
And it's funny because, so Kevin Stefanski is the first coach to win a playoff game under the new Browns, right?
Oh, that's right.
What was unique about it was he wasn't at the playoff game because he tested positive for COVID.
Oh, my God. That's
so
awesome.
Mike Pfeiffer was the acting head coach.
Who
Stefanski came back for the game against the Chiefs, and they lost.
It's funny because that wiped Bill Belichick from the Cleveland book. So at one point, Bill Belichick was the last coach to win a playoff game for two franchises. So, but no more. Kevin Stefanski's there.
So that's quite an assortment of something.
Yeah, but it looks like their suffering might at least be alleviated for a while. They do have a good team, and I know you talk with Mike about the current teams. It's probably going to be ugly for the Bears, but
because that one is already posted. We both picked the Bears to cover.
Oh, what's the line like?
7.5.
That's it. Yeah, I might bet on the Bears there because I think Fields might post.
So, and we also had wondered if. For those of you who've made it this far in the podcast, you might as well tell you. So Mike and I recorded a podcast on Tuesday night, and we had audio problem that we didn't realize for like the last half hour. So we just re-recorded it on Thursday. And so there's a point where we're both wondering if the line moved when they ruled Andy Dalton out.
And
it didn't. But what I think was, had the Bears switched, said, hey, Dalton's healthy enough to play, and that line would have gone up.
It might have moved the other way.
It would have gone up. I bet it would have been 10.5. I think now part of it is with the Justin Fields thing is I'm sure Vegas thinks it gives him a better chance, But it also increases the number of dopey Bear fans who are going to bet on the Bears to cover so they can hedge. They don't have to raise the line and get the same amount of action.
Yep.
So.
Yep. Huh. By the way, whatever that war equivalent metric that Football Reference uses called AV, I don't know how they arrive at it, but I'll just trust it for these purposes.
Greatest player of all time?
Jim Brown.
Craig
Krenzel. It's not Jim Brown.
It's Craig Krenzel.
It's not what, no, in the Browns history, it's not Jim Brown.
Oh, it's Kevin Mack.
It is. It is Webster Slaughter. It's Clay Matthews.
Apparently. Oh, bullshit.
I know, right?
Yeah, well, it's a lineman who played, or no, it was a linebacker. Bruce was the offensive. So, linebacker who played for, like, what, 17 seasons?
Yeah.
So, it's clearly he accumulated endurance. That stat.
Yeah, Brown only played 9 years. Well, so is War, I guess, too. The War is, it can go backwards, but it is cumulative, ultimately. I'm just struck by the fact that these are two teams that have a very proud ancient histories that have been in the league for 70 years, and they've had so little interaction with each other. And they have like very similar sort of a founding presence, a sort of legendary.
That all ends now with, I would think, this is probably the Super Bowl matchup for the next 5 or 6 years.
Sure, yeah. It's pretty much Yankees, Dodgers, or, you know,
people
Steelers,
Cowboys. Do you remember there was a time when the Bears and Browns weren't going at each other every February? I don't.
Hard to believe.
Justin Fields and Baker Mayfield.
Yeah, I mean, I'm impressed that I came up with Webster Slaughter. Like, I'm hard-pressed to just come up with random Browns.
It's
just
because
like,
most Browns are random Browns.
Like, you know, Ozzie was a Hall of Famer, Brian Seib, you know, I was rooting for those Browns.
Well, I mean,
teams
they had that great run of quarterbacks. It's like the Bears, you know, the Bears we tick off. Like, did Krenzel ever play for the Browns? I don't know. He played for the Bengals.
No, but he went to Ohio State, so he's familiar with the streets
of
Ohio.
Craig Krenzel and Will Fuhrer and Peter Tom Willis and that stuff. They've got, like, Charlie Fry.
Oh, yeah.
Good and Derek Anderson and Deshaun Kaiser.
True. Well, and probably
they got a million. It was a million of them. They were same like the Bears. The 4 or 5 guys would play quarterback for them in a season.
Basically, just another
Brady
parallel
Quinn.
On the negative. Yeah, I remember Brady Quinn. I think they probably burned a high draft pick on him, right?
Drafted him. He did the Aaron Rodgers thing without the excellence. He slid. He sat at the table and watched pick after pick after pick go.
Is that what it was? And yeah. I think they were obviously.
I don't
right.
think he went quite as low as. But everybody thought he was going like really early, and he was just sitting there.
God, I had high hopes for Brady Quinn when Charlie Weiss and his front butt came to town flashing the Super Bowl rings. He'd basically ridden Bill Belichick's coattails on.
Well, he's handsome.
He was. And did I mention the front butt?
Yeah, he was. He was not handsome, but Brady was.
Yeah, no, yeah, he was.
Still is. He's Mr. College Football now for Fox.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, 22nd pick. So he just almost exactly like Rodgers. The people had him, you know, pegged to be a. Well, with the Rodgers thing, the weird thing about the Rodgers thing was he was almost the number one pick. It was either him or Alex Smith.
Alex Smith.
Then he doesn't go till like 23.
Yes. And then he sat on the bench for 3 years.
Yep. And then. The one time he got in during those, so Favre gets hurt, but of course it's Brett Favre, so it's not going to be an injury that's going to keep him out.
Yeah,
he's going to be back the next week.
Killers.
Rodgers goes out, breaks his foot during the game.
Oh,
like his first chance
that.
To get a run as a quarterback because Favre went out fairly early in the game. Rodgers is out with a broken foot.
Yeah.
Favre probably just went back in with a broken hand.
Yeah.
He'll just play left-handed. Oh, we were so close to never having to put up with the Aaron Rodgers era.
I know. That's the year we drafted Cedric Benson, 2005.
Well, you know, the Bears weren't in the market for a quarterback because hadn't they drafted Rex the year before?
2 years before. The Tommy was the year before.
Oh, yeah. Well, that one they did all right with.
Yeah. Yeah, they did all right.
Yeah,
but, you know,
the Tommy Harris pick is like the one time where a team actually the Bears have done it a few times. They've tried it a lot of times. Remember Pat Riley? Draft the guy coming off the injury. Well, with Tommy, the whole thing was he's a great player, but because of his – it was his back, I think, right?
Or his knees. Back, yeah.
He wasn't going to have a long career. And the Bears basically said, we don't care. Right. He's going to be great. Well, we have him, and he was. The problem was he crapped out. Like, they just needed to get, like, 2 more months out of him.
I know.
I shudder to think what he could have, what he would have done in the rain to those to that Colt offensive line. But he wasn't around to do it. We had Tank Johnson instead. Nope. Yeah, the other guy would be they got Eddie Jackson in the fourth round because Eddie had a broken foot the year before in Alabama. He was still there.
And for a couple years, then in that case, that actually worked out. But yeah, that's a risky.
Oh, Eddie's back.
Wow.
Eddie's back. Forced a fumble. Tackle for a loss last week. Yeah. He got tired of me berating him, and now he's going to be back to all pro.
Yeah, I can't wait. With bated breath.
But yeah, I mean, we could do a whole thing on terrible Bear and Brown draft picks, I'm sure.
Well, yeah, because I'm wondering how many busters, like Tim Couch has to be considered a buster. Like, how many quarterback busters did they have? How many running back busters did they have? Because we had, like, quarterbacks, Bears busters, just off the top of my head. You know, I'm not going to call Grossman a buster because he took him to the Super Bowl. But, McNown, you could almost call Harbaugh a freaking buster. He's a first-round pick. Running backs, though, Rashad Salaam, Cedric Benson. Curtis Enos, I mean, some all-timers there. At least Salaam got 1,000 yards. Enos and Benson was – Enos was really the worst. But, I don't know if you can't even consider Trubisky a bust at quarterback because he's amongst the franchise leaders.
All right. So do you want to hear the –
passing yards.
I'm tempted to just go. So, yeah, the – I'm not going all through all these guys. Milt Plum, of course, a great quarterback for them for many years.
Sure.
Frank Ryan, Mike Phipps. There's a good Bear
future
Brown
Bear
connection.
Yeah, part of that troika.
He was succeeded by Brian Sipe.
Phipps of the Bears.
And then Gary Danielson. They had a lot of Bernie Kosar.
At the end of Danielson's career, they had a pretty good run there then between Sipe and Kosar. I'm surprised Kosar didn't play long enough to surpass Sipe. He's got to be close.
Well, part of that was Belichick first benched him and then cut him for Vinny Testaverde. That actually was a big part of why Belichick got fired. It was part of why he was so unpopular.
Kosar was incredibly popular.
Problem was Vinny played well for them.
Yeah, Vinny had figured out his colorblindness or something and was actually turning it around.
Well, the colorblindness thing. I remember this as a – well, not as a kid.
You've talked about it.
The fact that the Bucks home uniforms looked like the other team's road uniforms.
Yeah, it's an opposite. They create –
he couldn't tell the difference because that light orange was basically the same color. So that's great. You draft this guy, number one overall. Change your fucking uniforms.
Yeah.
So when they come back, this is when the quarterback bums really show up. So they start with Tim Couch and Ty Detmer as his backup.
So Couch really had to be a buster. He was the
Tim must have got hurt his second year because it gave a lot of starts to a future Super Bowl winning coach. You'll never guess.
McVay?
No,
he didn't want a Super Bowl.
No, it's a fit when he didn't play in the NFL.
Sean Payton? No, he played in the NFL. What?
It's a relatively recent Super Bowl winner, and he was a former quarterback. Probably best known as a Brett Favre backup.
Brett Favre backup, like not Mark Brunell. Lay it on me. I'm missing
Doug Peterson.
Obvious. Oh, yeah, of course. Peterson, yeah.
So then Couch comes back. He got to start all 16 games in 01. Then Kelly Holcomb.
I remember Kelly Holcomb.
Holcomb played in a playoff game against the against the Steelers when Tommy Maddox went nuts and the Browns blew another lead and the Steelers won. That was been their other.
We talked about that. That was the Carson Palmer. No, that was the Bengals. My bad. I'm sorry. So Holcomb was their quarterback in their first playoff appearance. Couch was hurt. Okay. Couch had to be hurt or did they already give up on him? Because that was 2004. Couch would have otherwise been like a 26-year-old.
2004, he was gone. Jeff Garcia was their primary quarterback that year.
I remember that.
And the great Luke McCown, Josh's brother.
Josh's brother, but not related to Cade McNown.
Then they gave Trent Dilfer a spin. He split time with Charlie Fry. Then Derek Anderson split time with Charlie Fry. Then they did it again.
Yeah.
Then 2008, they had a Bear-like season where four guys started at quarterback. Derek Anderson, that's... Brady Quinn, Ken Dorsey, and Bruce Gradkowski.
Another Mac quarterback. They had a couple Mac.
Did you remember that Jake DeLome played for them in 2010?
Nope.
Nope, nobody remembers that. Not Jake nope. probably doesn't remember that. Colt McCoy and Seneca Wallace.
Colt McCoy.
Brandon Texas. Whedon from Oklahoma State started 15 games for them in 2012.
Was that the year they went like 1-15? I don't know. All right.
No, that was the, DeShone Kizer season.
Oh, yeah. 2012, they actually.
And they tried Colt McCoy, still playing in the NFL. Went Colt McCoy, Jason Campbell, future Bear.
What year?
Or no,
is this 13. Yeah, former Bear. Bear. He was the Bear. Right.
Is that between Washington, Oakland, and the Bears?
Yeah, sure.
Brian Hoyer got three starts.
That was a future Bear now at this point, but another from today's perspective.
Brian Hoyer started 13 games in 2014. A guy who started two, Johnny Football.
Johnny Manziel. They had Manziel. You know what? We almost ended this podcast without mentioning Manziel, another infamous, ignominious draft pick.
Then 2015.
Well, that's another one of their quarterback busts, too.
Luke McCown's brother started eight games. Josh McCown.
Former Bear. So wait a second. Three straight years in a row, their leading passer was a former or future Bear. I'm seeing a lot of the parallels are not a
coincidence. I'll tell you why you don't win much. Listen to this bunch. 2016, Cody Kessler, Robert Griffin III.
RG3.
Or as they call him on the Dan Patrick Show, Robert Griffin Jr. III, because one of their callers called him that one time. Robert Griffin Jr. III. And Josh McCown. And then Kevin Hogan got one start in the winless season. DeShone Kizer got the other 15. And then 2018, things calmed down.
Yeah, the laughs come to an end. Yep. They are
Tyrod Taylor started three games. You know, he's not Tyrod anymore.
Even if they step on their dick going forward, this is, no matter what, this is the golden age of Browns 2 in football.
Because Baker Mayfield has now started every game in 19, every game in 20. He started 13 games in 18, and now he'll start his third game on Sunday.
Okay, so basically Sunday.
Even though for all the world it looked like he separated his shoulder tackling a guy in an interception last week. He limped off the field with his arm pinned to him, and he came right back.
Yeah. Well, they might have something. And it might push them ahead in this decades-old sort of taffy pull amongst once-proud franchises that just can't get out of their own way. Looks like Cleveland might be pulling ahead, and they can demonstrate that on Sunday.
So by the end of this season, if he stays healthy, Baker Mayfield will move. This is amazing.
How close to Saipe?
So they'll play 30. By the end of this season, Baker Mayfield will have started the fifth most games at quarterback in Browns history.
And that's total Browns.
The guys ahead of him, Brian Saipe, Bernie Kosar, Frank Ryan, and Otto Graham.
Wow. That's not that we needed any further punctuation on the similarities between these two franchises, but that's certainly...
Unless catastrophe hits, you're about to see a Bear quarterback do the same thing.
Yes.
Justin Fields hopefully stabilizes the position for the next 15
even
years
if he's
and blows through everything.
Yes. You know, Cutler proved it was not a high bar because Cutler was good, but so maddeningly inconsistent and disappointing, and he stayed upright enough is all it took. All you have to do is stay upright for 5 years, and you will be the next Bears all-time leading passer.
I would like if I had time, I should use it for a lot of better stuff than this. But one of the things I would do is I would go back and I would make sure that Mike Martz never became the offensive coordinator for the Bears.
Do you think he fucked them up? Because that was the one year they went to the title game. You know,
they were running an offense that had passed its usefulness like 4 years before. And, you know, they got rid of Greg Olsen. They just did a lot of weird personnel stuff that set them back after Martz left. They've gotten rid of solid players, and they didn't have enough of them. The other thing they did under the whole Lovey regime, as much as I like Lovey, the priority was always defense. Always.
Yeah.
Even when they make the trade for Cutler,
Angelo made the splash.
They drafted defense. I mean, it took them a long time, and then they finally went out and got Brandon Marshall, who brought his own baggage, and that was probably destined to be a short-term success before he had to go. Paired him with Alshon.
And even in those three seasons, Brandon Marshall came so close to becoming the Bears' all-time leading receiver.
If he kept his head. Because he had one more year on the contract when they traded him, right?
I'm going to look it up because
He would have left as the all-time leading receiver. It would have been 4 years, right?
It would have been he played for the Bears because we know that that Johnny Morris is just over 5,000. Brandon for the Bears was 3 years and 3,524 yards, so over 1,000 a year. Had he played two more years,
which 5 years, he'd be the all-time leader. Well,
yeah.
And so I don't want to be redundant, but I like this, so we're gonna talk about it again in this one. So. If Allen Robinson plays this year and next year, he will become the all-time leading.
Oh, is that right?
Receiver.
Good, because he's probably the best receiver for the Bears I've ever seen.
So what Pusteri and I were talking about during the preview podcast for the Browns was him dropping the touchdown pass from Fields. It was a perfect pass.
Yeah.
I said, you can't blame Allen Robinson. It's the first perfect pass that's ever been thrown to him, and maybe in his lifetime. We don't know who his high school quarterback was, but we know his college quarterback was Christian Hackenberg. And then we know his quarterback with the Jags was Blake Bortles. And then we know that his quarterback with the Bears was Mitch. This is the first time he's ever played with a real quarterback.
Okay. All right. Yep.
So it's going to take him a while to get used to the ball actually being where it's supposed to be.
He's put up some numbers, but I got you because this season included both games, he's at 3,210 yards. So he should be over 4,000 by the end of the year. We don't know what's going to happen with his contract, but if he's managed to be around next year, you're absolutely right. Yeah,
get an extra game, so he should be. He should have.
If Fields, he could do it this year. Fields really goes up.
I already did the math. He'd have to break Megatron's record.
I feel what's a single season yardage record? What is it? Over 2,000 yards? I don't even know, and I'm kind of embarrassed.
It's 1964 or something.
Okay. So it's not as much as a single season rushing record, but it's not even 2,000. So yeah, he's not going to do it this year.
Well, no, he could, but he has to average like 150 yards.
Well, he's got to set the single season record with a rookie quarterback who we're all very optimistic about, but
yeah, I don't really.
Yeah. 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 That's where we're at. That's Johnny Morris with his barely 5,000 yards, still being our all time leading receiver. I know Cleveland's got their tight end with a little bit more, but they're equally embarrassing.
Yeah, that's right. All-time record is 1,964 yards.
Interesting.
Calvin had to average 123 yards a game to get it. The year before, he gained 1,681 yards.
God, he was incredible. I know they're playing the Lions next week, and I don't know what we're going to be doing, but it never gets old to point out how the Lions just wasted so many great years from so many great players, but that's a topic for another day. And we've talked about it before anyway. So gotta remember we're talking with the Browns.
The Browns. It's great to have a franchise that we can
have a little bit of a cushion below us 2 weeks in a row. Cause what I learned last week was
only 3 weeks in a row.
Part of the reason I like doing this is that I'm always humbled that people like to listen to it. Some do. And, you know, it's therapeutic for me, but I also learn a lot. And I never quite appreciated, like, for the Bengals were so obviously one of those teams that have had a worse history than the Bears. There's more than you would think. It doesn't take away the pain that we've had to endure, but it is fascinating that there are so many teams that have been worse historically. And because the Browns haven't even been to a Super Bowl, they clearly are on that list. Yeah. So,
well, I mean, I think the thing that makes it – that's made it worse for Bear fans is it's not just the lack of Super Bowls and that kind of stuff. It's the fact that while the team we hate the most has had 25 years of Hall of Fame quarterbacking.
Yeah.
We have had the worst assortment of quarterbacks in NFL history.
I think worse than the Browns even. I don't think it's even worth going.
We don't have a
team.
If Jim McMahon played as long as Bernie Kosar, then the Bears would clearly be better, would be better situated. But he didn't. He only played a handful of seasons. And
it happens.
And so we don't have the equivalent of, and Bernie, that's not a huge bar to clear. Well, Bears can't clear it. That's how low it is. We can't get over it. So.
Yep. Someday, perhaps.
All right. Well, until next week.
You got it.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Many of us have herpes.